I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. Now, we are in the midst of a special edition. And again, we do these special editions from time to time because I kind of feel like I kind of need to focus on certain aspects of critical thinking, certain orientations that deal with the ability to think critically, the ability to perform well, and the ability to achieve a favorable outcome, or I like to use the term, the ability to achieve mission success. So that's why we're doing this series. Now, this special edition is called Big Picture Thinking. And again, a big picture thinking is an aspect of critical thinking. You could think of it this way. All right, critical thinking concerns itself primarily as a general category of thinking. So general thinking skills that enable one to think critically pretty much across the board. These are generalizable things. They are things that are, you could say that they're generally true in terms of being able to think well. They're also either implied directly or indirectly. It does cover things that are not going to work well. It would behoove all of us to know those kinds of things so that we don't get stuck in the mud. We don't get overcome by the quagmire of complexity, and we can actually do things useful and productive and helpful. Oftentimes, we are not able to perform because we are not thinking well. I could put it a little bit more succinctly. We are not thinking critically. I like to use that term. We are not reasoning effectively. We are not engaged in higher order reasoning. We are bogged down in the minutiae. We are bogged down in the technical details of the thing, or we are bogged down in the deluge of data that that modern enterprises and organizations produce. There is a deluge of data out there, and a lot of people are wedded to that. I'm not suggesting that we don't collect that data. I'm suggesting that we think beyond the data. We can raise our level of awareness that goes beyond the discrete data points. Discrete data point processing is not the pathway to success if that's all we are doing. Okay, so that's why we're dealing with this. So big picture thinking, this is episode number 9. I kind of think we're going to do one more to round it out to 10 episodes. After we finished episode number 5, I thought I was done. But as it turns out, no, there's a lot of stuff to cover here. And I wanted to do it in a way that was meaningful and useful and, you know, and informative. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to inform, share ideas so that we can all become better critical thinkers. And in this particular case, better at big picture thinking. Now, big picture thinking, of course, was first, I guess you could say, I use the term invented. Okay, that's true. It was first invented. It was first conceived of in the aviation industry, the aviation community. That's, of course, the community that I come from. I come from the aviation industry or the aviation community, and I was able to bridge across a number of subspecialties within the aviation community. The two big ones are, well, there was three. I could say there's two. You could also say three. The two big ones were operations and design. Those are the two big ones. I was an operator for almost exactly for 40 years. I operated, or another way of saying that is I flew as pilot in command or as captain. Those two things mean the same thing. The first one is a military term and the second one is a civilian term. But so I was pilot in command, captain of a whole bunch of airplanes. All of them were high performance airplanes, and then I got involved also in the design of things related to the aviation industry. Operational stuff and design initiatives. And there was there's actually quite a few things that related to design, engaged in design initiatives of many things. Most of them were complex and difficult to develop, and they were also very difficult to operate. So anyway, so that's where I come from, and that's where this whole thing started, which is called big picture thinking. It started there, and it's it's taken on a life of its own. It is a major part of a growing list of areas, a growing list of disciplines, a growing list of communities, a growing list of enterprises, industries, disciplines. I said that already. Whatever. All right. So across the board, it could be you know, it could be the medical community. Certainly, they have adopted many of the things. It could be the automobile industry. It could be the package delivery systems that we have. It could be anything to do with global business operations and so forth and so on. The list goes on and on and on. Just as an aside note here, I noticed a recent article in the Wall Street Journal that was listing the top companies in the world. And this is a report that's put out by the Drucker Institute on a regular basis. I think it's a yearly basis. And they listed Amazon as number one. Okay, so that's just an aside note. Well, we're going to get into that in more detail on some future shows coming up. But I just wanted to throw that out here. All right. And so a couple of more things as we begin this series. One thing is that, okay, so why are we not covering the current political news? Why are we not covering that on this On Throttle Up? And my answer is that, well, we do cover certain aspects of the, you know, the current news, the current socioeconomic news, the current political news, however you want to say it, what's going on in the world. Okay, but you know, there's lots and lots of news sources out there that cover the current events in various ways, and some of them are particularly good. There's some that I like. There's some of them that are average, run of the mill, and then some of them are not particularly good at all. So it was never intended for Throttle Up to be just another you know, current news source outlet. It was never intended to. Throttle Up was always supposed to be different. We try to make it a different kind of view, different kind of understanding of reality, a different perspective. Now, why do we want to do that? Well, because we want it to be not the same old cookie cutter radio show and podcast. We want to be more than that. By the way, we are expanding as we speak. So Throttle Up will be not only a radio show on Red State Talk Radio, which we are delighted to be on this great radio station. It's also a podcast. You can find us on iTunes, as well as go to our website, throttleupradio.com, and download either the current podcast or the archives. We have, I think we have almost all the shows archived in podcast format. And so that's very many. And you can kind of pick and choose when you go and look at the titles. And then we are in the process of cranking up a YouTube channel, a video channel. And so we're going to be producing videos on a regular basis. And these would be, well, you know, they're the video people, video experts tell me that, you know, the video shouldn't be any longer than 20 minutes. It's pretty much the attention span of most people. Some of them may have to be, but typically they should be no longer than 20 minutes, preferably somewhere less than 15 minutes. Okay, so we're going to try to stay within that, you know, that ballpark figure. I think we're probably going to be doing somewhere between 10 and 20 minutes on our videos. And how often are we going to produce them? The goal right now is to produce at least one video per month on various, which we would consider to be extremely important topics. And, of course, with our mobile devices, you can, you know, you can get the videos in almost any place that you can connect your mobile devices to some kind of a network. So if you are going to Starbucks and you are going to go grab yourself a cup of coffee or a latte or something like that, you can take your mobile device, your cell phone or your iPad, and you can connect to the Starbucks Wi-Fi, and you can download or you can listen, access the video through the YouTube video channel. And there you go. So you're off and running. A video is now kind of like the wave of the future, and so we're trying to address ourselves to that also. Okay, so what are we doing here on episode number 9? All right, so big picture thinking, episode number 9. And we're going to be talking about some, I think they're really fascinating aspects of big picture thinking and critical thinking. And the first one is an article that was published recently. Now, let me see if I can get it up here and open it up and take a look at it. And what I want to do here is I want to go ahead and read some excerpts from this article. Now, I think this happens to be, and what I try to do here for the listening audience, I try to keep things new and fresh and interesting. And so this is not standard of hopefully what I'm presenting here is not standard stuff. I also like to share, be able to use this platform to share ideas. So you're not just not listening to the ideas that I have in my head, but I try to broaden the scope. Again, I try to use big picture thinking and consider the fact that, okay, well, there may be others out there that are thinking in similar terms. What have they thought about? What are the things that they have produced and developed? What are the ideas that they are pursuing? What are the initiatives that are being pursued or being considered or being launched? What are they? And so I like to share various ideas and concepts that others are thinking as well, because, you know, this is a big tent, and I think all ideas are great to consider. I would suggest that we all strive to become better at critical thinking. We should all be striving on a regular basis to be able to think critically in ways that would help us in our pursuit of trying to achieve some kind of a favorable outcome. What is the best way for us to proceed in doing so? And first and foremost, on the top of the list here is, of course, the ability to think critically. If we cannot do such a thing very well, it's likely that we are not going to be successful in whatever we are doing. Now, that's you might say, okay, well, that's kind of harsh and unforgiving a bit, but I would say, well, that may be so, but it is it's also true. We know that from an enormous amount of experience, just a gigantic amount of experience. And in my field of aviation, I can tell you quite conclusively that if we cannot think critically, we are not going to be able to solve the really big problems. We are not going to be able to deal with the really big issues that come our way, and we will not be successful. We simply will not be successful. There is a whole host of airlines that have gone belly up since the beginning of aviation. The number would be, if you looked at the number, it would be staggering. Now, we learned a lot from that. We learned what simply doesn't work. And we haven't stopped learning. We still are learning. But one of the things that we know does work, not only in operating or flying the airplane, but also in managing the company is big picture thinking. Okay, so this article, I'm going to spend some time on it. Now, this comes from the organization called The Systems Thinker. It is actually a website, and it is promoting the ideas of J.W. Forrester. Dr. Forrester passed away recently, but he was the kind of the leading figure in systems dynamics. And so this this website continues in his legacy. The title of this article that appears in this website is, again, the website is called The Systems Thinker. You can go ahead and Google it and, you know, and sign up for articles and stuff like that. They have a good stock of very useful articles and webinars. Okay, so this article is called From Fragmentation to Integration, Building Learning Communities. It starts off by saying that we, and this is, again, now keep in mind, this is the authors are speaking. They have some kind of harsh words to say, but I'm gonna you know, read it as they have written it, and you can agree with them or not. But I do think that they're making a very useful point here, so I don't want to water it down. Okay, it starts off by saying that we live in an era of massive institutional failure. And this is a quote from a gentleman by the name of D. Hock, founder and CEO emeritus of Visa International. We need only look around us to see evidence to support D's statement, it says. Corporations, for example, are spending millions of dollars to teach high school graduates in their workforces to read, write, and perform basic arithmetic. Our healthcare system is in a state of acute crisis. The U.S. spends more on healthcare than any other industrialized country, and yet the health of our citizens is the worst among those same nations. Our educational system is increasingly coming under fire for not preparing our children adequately to meet the demands of the future. Our universities, it says, are losing credibility. Our religious institutions are struggling to maintain relevance in people's lives. Goes on to say, our government is increasingly dysfunctional, caught in a vicious cycle of growing special interest groups, distrust, and corruption. The corruption may be the healthiest. The corporation, it says, may be the healthiest institution in the U.S., which isn't saying much. It goes on to say that one of the reasons for this widespread institutional failure is the knowledge-creating system, the method by which human beings collectively learn and by which society's institutions improve and revitalize themselves, is deeply fragmented. It says that this fragmentation has developed so gradually that few of us have noticed it. We take the disconnections between the branches of knowledge and between knowledge and practice as a given. Now, it goes on to describe a knowledge-creating system. So this is a section of the article. It says that explains what is a knowledge-creating system. Before we can address the issues of fragmentation, we need to establish what has been fragmented. In other words, what do we mean by a knowledge-creating system, and what does it mean to say it is fragmented? We believe that human communities have always attempted to organize themselves to maximize the production, transmittal, and application of knowledge. In these activities, different individuals fulfill different roles with varying degrees of success. For example, in indigenous cultures, elders articulate timeless principles grounded in their experience to guide their tribe's future actions. Doers, whether warriors, growers, hunters, or nannies, try to learn how to do things better than before and continually improve their craft. And coaches and teachers help people develop their capacities to both perform their roles and grow as human beings. These three activities, which we can term theory building, practice, and capacity building, are intertwined and woven into the fabric of the community in a seamless process that restores and advances the knowledge of the tribe. One could argue that this interdependent knowledge-creating system is the only way that human beings collectively learn, generate new knowledge, and change their world. It goes on to say that we can view this system for producing knowledge as a cycle. People apply available knowledge to accomplish their goals. This practical application in turn provides experiential data from which new theories can be formulated to guide future actions. New theories and principles then lead to new methods and tools that translate theory into practice, into practical know-how, the pursuit of new goals and new experience, and the cycle continues. Imagine that the cycle of knowledge creation is a tree, it says. This is a pretty good metaphor, by the way. I like the way they have done this. The tree's roots are the theories. Like theories, the roots are invisible to most of the world, and yet the health of the root system to a large extent determines the health of the tree. The branches are the methods and tools which enable translation of theories into new capabilities and practical results. The fruit is that practical knowledge. In a way, the whole system seems designed to produce the fruit. But if you harvest and eat all the fruit from the tree, eventually there will be no more trees. So some of the fruit must be used to provide the seeds for more trees. The tree as a whole is a system. It goes on to say that the tree is a wonderful metaphor because it functions through a profound, amazing transformational process called photosynthesis. The roots absorb nutrients from the soil. Eventually, the nutrients flow through the trunk and into the branches and leaves. In the leaves, the nutrients interact with sunlight to create complex carbohydrates, which serve as the basis for development of the fruit. So, what are the metaphorical equivalents that allow us to create fruits of practical knowledge in our organizations? We can view research activities as expanding the root system to build better and richer theories. Capacity building activities extend the branches by translating the theories into usable methods and tools. The use of these methods and tools enhances people's capabilities. The art of practice in a particular line of work transforms the theories, methods, and tools into usable knowledge as people apply their capabilities to practical tasks, much as the process of photosynthesis converts the nutrients into leaves, flowers, and fruit in our society. It goes on to discuss these three things, the research, practice, and capacity building. It says that research represents any disciplined approach to discovery and understanding with a commitment to share what's being learned. We're not referring here, it says, to white-coated scientists performing laboratory experiments. We mean research in the same way that a child asks, what's going on here? By pursuing such questions, research, whether performed by academics or thoughtful managers or consultants, reflected on their experiences, continually generate new theories about how our world works. The second item is practice. Practice is anything that a group of people does to produce a result. It's the application of energy, tools, and effort to achieve something practical. An example is a product development team that wants to build a better product more quickly at a lower cost. By directly applying the available theory, tools, and methods in our work, we generate practical knowledge. The third item is capacity building. Capacity building links research and practice. It is equally committed to discovery and understanding and to practical know-how and results. Every learning community includes coaches, mentors, and teachers, people who help others build skills and capabilities through developing new methods and tools that help make theories practical. Okay, so that's a pretty good discussion of what we're trying to get at in terms of big picture thinking with respect to using the tree as a metaphor. I want to spend a little bit of time on institutional fragmentation and then go on to technical rationality. All right, these are two really crucial ideas in the marketplace of ideas as we pursue big picture thinking. All right, so let me press on here, and then we'll take a short break. Institutionalized fragmentation. It says that if knowledge is best created by this type of integrated system, how did our current systems and institutions become so fragmented? To answer that question, we need to look at how research, practice, and capacity building are institutionalized in our culture. For example, what institution do we most associate with research? Universities. What does the world of practice encompass? Corporations, schools, hospitals, and nonprofits. And what institutions do we most associate with capacity building? People helping people in the practical world. Consulting or the HR function within an organization. Each of these institutions has made that particular activity its defining core. And because research, practice, and capacity building each operate within the walls of separate institutions, it is easy for the people within these institutions to feel cut off from each other, leading to suspicion, stereotyping, and us versus them mindset. I would say parenthetically that this is, of course, silo thinking. This is thinking in a silo and staying within a silo and limiting oneself, self-limiting oneself, if you will. This isolation, it says, leads to severe communication breakdown. For example, many people have argued that the academic community has evolved into a private club. Nobody understands what goes on but the club members. They talk in ways that only members can understand, and the members only let in others like themselves. It goes on to say that consulting institutions have also undermined the knowledge-creating process by making knowledge proprietary. Finally, corporations have contributed to the fragmentation by their bottom-line orientation, which places the greatest value on those things that produce immediate practical results. It says that they have little patience for investing in research that may have payoffs over the long term or where payoffs cannot be specifically quantified. Okay, one last point here of what is going wrong, or one last point within the problem statement. Technical rationality. one root of fragmentation. How did we reach the state of fragmentation? It asks. And it says, over hundreds of years, we had developed the notion that knowledge is the province of the expert, the researcher, or the academic. Often, the very term science is used to connote this kind of knowledge, as if the words that come out of the mouths of scientists are somehow inherently more truthful than everyone else's words. This concept is known as technical rationality. First, you develop the theory, then you apply it, or first the expert come in and figure out what's wrong, and then you use their advice to fix the problem. Of course, although the advice may be brilliant, sometimes we just can't figure out how to implement it. But maybe the problem isn't in the advice. Maybe it's in the basic assumption that this method is how learning or knowledge creation actually works. Maybe the problem is really in the very way of thinking, that first you must get the answer, then you must apply it. I would say that that's getting things completely wrong and backwards. First you must not get the answer. First you must figure out what is the problem. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to play a couple of audio clips as we proceed along on this road, which we call big picture thinking. Okay, here is a video clip, which is a discussion of systems change, and it's a system change overview. Now, it's a bit long, and I'm going to play it because I think it's important for us to understand it. If we are going to think in terms of the big picture, we have to understand that things are constantly in change. Things are constantly moving. Everything is evolving. Things are in continuous motion. And so the only constant is change itself. And so in order to maintain an accurate view of the big picture, that we must recognize that the picture is dynamic in nature, and we have to be able to understand its dynamism. We have to be able to understand it in terms of not only what does it currently look like, but what could it likely look like somewhere in the future, either short or long term. And so that's particularly important. So I'm going to play this thing right now, and we'll sit back, and I'm going to sit back and listen as well. And hopefully we can get something useful out of this. This comes from, by the way, a great organization called Systems Innovation. They do a lot of this higher order thinking stuff, and they are part of the intellectual landscape that we need to consider as we pursue critical thinking and, of course, big picture thinking.
The term systems change is a relatively new one, coming to prominence within just the last decade. As such, it is safe to say that it is still in its formative stage, with many different perspectives on what it is exactly. We may find many people using the same term, but depending on their background, it means many different things. Before we start, let us take a look at a number of these interpretations. Ashoka defines systems change in terms of tackling root causes. Systems change is an approach to tackling the root causes of a problem by identifying and creating shifts in the systems that are responsible for the problem. The author and advisor, Charlie Ledbetter, talks about it in terms of transformation and new rules. Innovations which are transformative and generative, which change the rules of the game, create new relationships, and create, with that, new flows and resources through society. Forum for the Future's definition is in terms of changing systems pattern or structure. System change is the emergence of a new pattern of organization or system structure, that pattern being the physical structure, the flows and relationships, or the mindsets or paradigms of a system. It is also a pattern that results in new goals of the system. John Kania, who developed the systems change practices at New Profit, talks about it in terms of shifting the system conditions when he says, "We're thinking about systems change not as an issue or a person that needs to be fixed. It's the set of conditions that surround that individual. We need to work on shifting the conditions that hold the problem in place." In many ways, we can see the rise of systems change as a response to the growing complexity of the challenges faced by societies around the world. As a function of this complexity, we are moving from a world where one organization could drive changes to a world where that is no longer possible because of the scale, interconnectivity, and complexity of the issues today. The reality is that when you are addressing large-scale complex challenges and you are sincerely motivated to find solutions, then one quite quickly realizes that what you need are methodologies that are significantly different from current ones. New innovation methodologies, different mindsets, you need a new kind of leadership. You also need different ways of collaborating and organizing people around a given issue. As Kyle Peck says, systemic change is an approach to change that acknowledges the complexity of the way the world really works. Systems change embodies this realization and draws upon a new set of ideas from complexity and systems thinking to provide an approach that is more appropriate given the complexity of these issues. It is precisely the complexity of today's issues that defies traditional transactional or singular interventions, allowing the problem to perpetuate, be it climate change, homelessness, conflict, segregation, or intergenerational poverty. For those who are really committed to dealing with these wicked problems, the emphasis shifts to the structure of the systems that are creating the problems, rather than just dealing with the symptoms. As James Grayson of Blindspot Think Tank remarks, "If we were totally serious about climate change, then actually we would be looking at something much more systemic. We would actually be seeing climate change as a symptom, not just as a cause and the symptom being a result of the way that we run the world, the way that we set up the systems that we all live within, because currently they are set up to cause climate change and a range of other problems." Seeing and tackling these root causes derived from system structure requires a more holistic way of seeing the world. Systems change is based upon the paradigm and ideas of systems thinking, which is a holistic view of the world. We are always reasoning upwards to try and understand a system within its whole environment and context. This holistic approach allows us to recognize the many dimensions and facets to a system, to embrace this complexity rather than trying to reduce it. Jocelyn Bergeon expresses this key multidimensionality tenet of systems change when saying, "Complex issues are multidimensional, and whenever you try and reduce them to a single dimension, you are on the verge of making a dramatic mistake. Because by prescribing a solution that is unidimensional, you are about to make the problem even worse." Systems change is a response to the complexity of the world we live in, and with that, an acceptance that there is no silver bullet. Indeed, it is a recognition that such a narrow approach often makes the problem worse in the long run. Systemic change is a change that takes into account all the various pieces that influence a system. That means the people, the politics, the values, the reward systems, and the many other factors. Too often, we see social interventions that are service-rich and system-poor. People are bombarded by interventions from different providers, all of which add up to less than the sum of the parts. It is the system itself that pushes people into difficult situations or prevents them from getting out, and no simple summation of isolated interventions adds up to systems change. This holistic approach is very important as a starting condition when dealing with complex systems. As Petra Kunkel, director of the Collective Leadership Institute, notes, "Wholeness at a large scale is our ability to look at things from a distance and to take into account a larger perspective. Because if we don't do this, we do not only act in isolation, we may act in the naivety that the positive intention that we have will have a positive impact, and it may not necessarily be the case because we have not taken into account a larger context." Systems thinking, as the foundation for systems change, is important because it helps to elevate our thinking to the systems level. When we can do this, our approaches can become radically more innovative and effective. Think about a transport system. We see a bus passing. It is overloaded with people, so we think, "Oh, the transport authorities should put on more buses." This is a scarcity mindset that is inherent to a component-based vision of the world. If we can elevate our thinking and vision to the systems level, we might start to see the bus as part of an overlapping set of different networks. This vision would let us see that maybe instead it is a product of the lack of coordination between the different transport modes that create bottlenecks. This, in turn, would lead us to developing an alternative strategy, perhaps to restructure the system by better understanding the networks of connections and connecting things in new ways. Then maybe we would not need more buses. Indeed, our initial solution based upon a partial view of the system may well have made things worse by adding congestion and perpetuating a system that had structural dysfunctionalities. A central premise here is that people have to become aware of the systems they form part of before they can operate on that level and start to affect change at that level. Indeed, it is precisely this that we are struggling with as societies, that we are not really aware of the complex systems we are a part of or how they work, which means we have little to no capacity to intentionally shape them. The result of this is that all we can do is react to unforeseen events when they occur, and then create some rationale as to why they occurred, so that we feel like we are in control. Petra Kunkel puts it well when she remarks, "Any sustainability challenges we are dealing with, they are actually a result of a fragmented way of thinking. So can we take our thinking one level up, so that we can defragment the thinking, so that we can defragment the actions?" Systems change is a theory of change that is nonlinear. It is based upon complexity and system theory's understanding of complex nonlinear organization and how they change over time. This nonlinear approach stands in contrast to most theories of change that are based upon certain assumptions of linear causality, stability, predictability, and the capacity to directly affect the system toward changing in a pre-specified desired direction. The dominant mechanistic paradigm we live with today views change as something that can be managed through centralized, top-down design processes that produce clear, predictable outcomes. This type of linear, cause-and-effect thinking has influenced the design and development of our industrial age institutional arrangements that contribute to many of the global wicked problems we face today. A new cross-domain collection of knowledge dealing with the dynamics of change within complex systems is now emerging that challenges these assumptions and has the potential to create new approaches to management, design, and problem-solving. Insights from a diversity of fields such as mathematics, physics, ecology, sociology, and organizational development have revealed that change within open complex systems takes place in counterintuitive ways. Although change within such organizations can be stimulated and even lightly directed, it cannot be managed or controlled, nor can outcomes be precisely predicted. Acceptance of the nonlinear nature to complex organizations and the fact that we cannot directly change them through linear causal interaction leads to a new approach to change and a whole new kind of strategy. The strategy of the systems changer is about identifying leverage points and then performing systems acupuncture to strategically influence those important points in the system where small interventions can have long-term lasting effects. Systems change eventuates when the interventions are made in the right place, given the right motives and combined in the right way. This is about shifting the conditions that hold the problem in place, and it takes multiple synchronized and coordinated interventions at leverage points that are often found at counterintuitive places in the system, and typically not easy to find. Systems change is certainly not a theoretical exercise. It aims at actually changing the complex systems that make our economies and societies work, or not work, as the case may be. Thinking in systems, having a holistic view, identifying the leverage points, and formulating a strategy is just the beginning. The aim is to build ecosystems of actors that have a shared understanding of the system, making them capable of collective action. These ecosystems of actors need to develop shared system diagrams to build everyone's awareness, to build shared language. This is about building the collective intelligence of the group and the collective agency of the group. Beyond awareness, these platforms need to have agency through collaborations that enable a diversity of actors across the system to start to synchronize their activities in synergistic ways. Platforms for system change work to build systems awareness through bringing people together, creating structures that enable them to work together, make collaboration an attractor, and demonstrate value to the stakeholders. Likewise, they have to build adaptive learning feedback loops for the network to explore and learn about the problem and possible solutions. Collaborative change requires building shared understanding, shared language, and ultimately some form of collective intelligence. This starts with recognizing the other actors and the need to work together, then coordinating, collaborating, synthesizing. The result is the emergence of some new functional pattern in the system. As Co-Impact highlights in their approach, systems change is about realigning the underlying relationships, functions, incentives, and motivations to a higher, outcome-focused equilibrium. Systemic innovations can be suddenly pushed forward by a crisis, cultural changes, or disruptive technology, among other things. More often, they are the result of slow but cumulative processes entailing changing infrastructures, behaviors, and cultures that reach a tipping point, at which stage large-scale systems changes happen very fast. The fall of the Berlin Wall is but one such often cited example of systems change. Other examples may include the civil rights movement in the U.S., the creation of welfare states in the mid-20th century, the spread of democracy. One of the most recent, large-scale, and dramatic illustrations of systems change may be the rapid spread of the market system around the world, with the rise of economic globalization in the 90s, and the changes in patterns of work, economic conditions, power, and culture that it has resulted in for billions of people. However, none of these processes of systems change were on the strategic level that we are looking for today. They changed systems, yes, but not in the strategic fashion we will be outlining in this course. Today, we are searching for a more conscious and strategic way to influence and shape complex organizations when needed. It can be easily argued that examples of people doing such a thing at the scale required does not yet exist. Systems change with intentionality, where we really bring new ideas and thinking together with deep insight and analysis, combined with the formation of platforms for collaboration that drive comprehensive systems-level change within a large complex system, such as the global food system or energy system. This has not been realized at scale yet. We have changed systems, but we have never really consciously and strategically changed one of the kinds of global systems to a higher equilibrium that ultimately need to be changed if we are going to realize sustainable outcomes for all. Such things, it could be argued, are largely beyond us today, and thus true examples probably do not exist yet, but hopefully lie somewhere in the future. We might say that it is part of the systems change movement to bring them into being as an example of possible ways forward. We highlight this in an attempt to ensure that systems change remains an active endeavor on all levels, both on the small scale but also on the largest scales possible. In a talk by Indy Johar, he framed the situation well by saying, "The scale of change, if we want to survive as a global civilization, will be of an order that is unimagined." Let us start the conversation from that perspective.
Okay, so that is that's a great discussion of a key aspect of big picture thinking and critical thinking, of course, and it's related to big picture thinking. So thinking in systems. This whole discussion is vital if we want to proceed ahead. In a productive way to be able to build and make our large-scale systems work effectively and efficiently. After all, big-picture thinking is a major component of systems thinking. They both are complementary. Often, as you can see, they're synonymous. They are largely about the same kinds of things that we need to consider. Now you say, okay, why call it one versus the other? I guess it's because it's being done, and so I wanted to avoid some confusion, and I wanted to acknowledge the fact that there are two schools of thought that might very well be almost identical. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.